The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Thank you very much for coming. My name is Andy Cahan. I'm Director of Author Events here at the Free Library of Philadelphia, and I'm very excited to welcome back our guest this evening. I really don't need to do any more than that, because we all know and value Oliver Sacks' never-ending anthropology of the neural life of our species. So rather than go on, I will tell you that Dr. Sacks will be interviewed by Anna Doty, the smart and creative curator of the Mutter Museum at the College of Physicians. I will also tell you that 2 weeks ago, Dr. Sacks turned 80 years old. So tonight, I thought that we could all sing Happy Birthday to welcome Oliver to the stage. On three, are you ready? One, two, three. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Oliver. Happy birthday to you.
Happy birthday.
Thank you. I'm proclaiming it with my T-shirt.
Yes.
I always associate birthdays and numbers with elements, and now I'm Mercury, which is 80.
Now, will you be wearing that T-shirt periodically?
No.
Sorry. All right, no more puns. We're going to go right to it. Now, your book, Hallucinations, absolutely wonderful. Let's just start with a basic question. There are many different definitions of the term hallucination. What is your definition?
A perception of something that isn't there. Okay. And it's just like a perception. It's projected outside. It seems completely real. One is maybe completely taken in by it. It's not like an image, because you create an image and you're the author, whereas with a hallucination you feel, who ordered that? Where's it come from? What's going on?
Right.
And of course it's different from a dream in that you're awake and watching it.
Wonderful. Your book talks about many different subtypes of hallucinations. They have many different names. I've forgotten them all. But one thing that I didn't see in the book was, did you ever have a case where you had a patient that was suffering from hallucinations, but you could find no cause? There was no pathological, physiological, or emotional cause, and yet they were still hallucinating.
Oh, I think that's not infrequent. And it's... there was a huge census in the 1890s, and it's often been repeated, and about 10% of the population have occasional hallucinations. 10% who are fully conscious and who have been screened for any physical or mental illness. So I would imagine that most of you here have had one or two. Sometimes perhaps only hearing your name called. Yeah. Or hearing the phone ring in the middle of the night, but it doesn't ring a second time.
That's interesting. Things that I maybe have experienced but didn't categorize as a hallucination. Now I'm thinking about it. I've had those. How about raise your hands if you've ever experienced a hallucination? I'd like to... I think they might have skewed the percentage there.
But in a clinical context... it's often difficult for people to acknowledge hallucinations. The term has a frightening sort of resonance. It seems to perhaps connote dementia or mental illness, which it doesn't. When I speak with patients, I often avoid the term hallucination and somehow find my way discreetly, circuitously to it.
What might be a term you would use instead of hallucination?
Oh, illusion, misperception. Yeah. Just something odd.
Yeah.
Or just seeing something or hearing something.
Mm-hmm. I think another thing in the book that I was very intrigued, a bit dismayed, was to see that the foundations of some of my favorite literary works could be been rooted in pathology. So, for example, Lewis Carroll apparently suffered from classic migraines, which can cause some to experience hallucinations of body image, which could give rise to the Alice in Wonderland's the portion of the book where Alice changes size and shape. And then it was interesting that Edgar Allan Poe had hypnagogic hallucinations that he actively harvested from those hallucinations, works that he used in his short stories and in his poems. That made me wonder, where does the neurological pathology stop and the creative genius begin?
I don't think one should use the word pathology too readily. Mm-hmm. And again, if one has a hallucination, why not be inspired by it? Mm-hmm. It's a gift, or can be seen as that. And before the current medical era, the term hallucination was first used medically in the beginning of the 19th century. Before that, hallucinations were felt to come from above or below. And, and we still talk about the muses. A lot of people, and probably most of you, get some sort of visions when you're half asleep and lying in bed with your eyes closed. And as you say, Edgar Allan Poe had very vivid ones, and he would jerk himself awake suddenly so he could make a note of them. He used a very interesting phrase. He talked about the absolute novelty of hallucinations and felt that they could explore, delineate regions inaccessible to the imagination. Mm-hmm. And one of the things about hallucinations is that you could see or hear or smell or feel things you never experienced and could not imagine.
What is the artist or musician, in your experience, that you know has had hallucinations that you think has produced some amazing work because of those hallucinations?
I missed the first half of your sentence, I'm sorry.
An artist, in your opinion, an artist, yeah, musician, some creative type person who had hallucinations that produced an amazing body of work, what would be your favorite, your personal favorite, one of those?
Coleridge was stoned for much of the time, but then so was everyone then, Southey and Wordsworth and De Quincey and Baudelaire and over here Poe. Mm-hmm. And there have been some scientists who have seemingly been inspired by hallucinations. One of them, a man called Kekulé, had a vision of snakes going round and round in hexagons when he was on top of a bus half asleep. And this was the founding insight of structural chemistry.
Wow. That segues nicely. You were talking about being stoned. personal story now. You mentioned in your book your own drug use and your experimentation with hallucinogenic substances. Do you feel these experiences have helped or hurt your ability to understand hallucinations?
I'm inclined to say both. I think it. I cannot pretend that I did it purely to gain understanding and insight. I had some vulgar motives like pleasure. But I think it did help me understand the various forms of consciousness. You mentioned Lewis Carroll, sort of in his enlargement and getting smaller, but this is something you can also have with drugs, and which I had occasionally. I think it was a dangerous path. I'm glad I survived. I don't at all recommend it. But why should I conceal it? It was 40 years ago. Hallucinations could only be conveyed by first-person experiences. Right. So why not throw my own in?
Right. And this is nothing new. Our own Silas Weir Mitchell of the College of Physicians of Philadelphia in 1896 wrote about taking a sizable dose of mescal buttons, followed by four more doses, and then going out to see patients.
Yeah.
Now, again, this was 100-plus years ago. There was little, if any, drug regulation, and even less for the physician. And these physicians had access to these drugs. Now that we have strict regulations, but an ever-growing drug war, what are your general feelings on the illegality of hallucinogenic drugs?
Well, certainly when Weir Mitchell took it in the 1890s, it was a new and legitimate field of inquiry. And so it was, say, 60 years later when Aldous Huxley took mescal and wrote The Doors of Perception. It ceased to be kosher, really, with Timothy Leary and others. And books that became associated with a disturbing message about tuning out and not being a citizen. And responsible research on LSD and so forth really came to an end in the 1960s. It's undergoing something of a reconnaissance, of a renaissance now. And I think there's a great deal to learn.
Hypothetical question. If the U.S. were to declare tomorrow that all hallucinogenic drugs and substances were legal, would you start taking something again, and what would it be? How can I get some?
I think I risked my life when I was 30, and I wouldn't care to sort of submit my 80-year-old heart or brain to most of the things. I confess I rather liked mescal more than LSD. People dream of an ideal drug which would have no ill effects and no side effects, but there aren't any. And I think many drug-like effects can be obtained without drugs, by art and meditation. When I said one may hallucinate things which one has never seen or imagined before, one of these for me was the color indigo. Indigo was put in the spectrum by Newton because he felt that there should be seven colors. But no two people seem to agree as to what indigo was like. So I thought I wanted an experience of it, and I built up a sort of chemical launch pad. And then when I was really stoned, I said, I want to see indigo now. And as if thrown by a paintbrush, a beautiful pear-shaped blob of the purest indigo appeared on the wall. And although I'm an old Jewish atheist, I thought, this is the color of heaven. This is the color which Giotto tried to get, but never could. And I leant towards it in a sort of ecstasy, and it vanished. And And I, for months afterwards, I kept turning things over. I went to a mineralogy museum. I was looking for indigo. I didn't see it. But I did see it once again. And that was when I went to a concert in New York and the Egyptology galleries of the museum, of the Met. And in the first half of the concert, I was entranced and raptured by Monteverdi. And I got high on Monteverdi. And in that state, I wandered into the gallery and I saw amulets and other things of the purest indigo. And I thought, well, it really exists. But then my mood changed, and at the end of the concert I went out and they were no longer indigo. They were just mauve or blue. And that was in 1965. I've never seen it since.
Wow.
But it did make me feel that, you know, that music, for example, can get you where drugs are.
So music is as a drug to induce hallucinations? Now, so are you advocating actively trying to hallucinate without the substances, without any chemical effects?
Mediums and scryers, you know, become adept at hallucinations. Certain forms of meditation can. And if one can say this without offense, certain forms of religious training can, in particular the sort of the discipline of prayer practiced by evangelicals, involves a very concentrated, heightened perception. One's told, what did Jesus look like? Which way was he facing? What was he wearing? And this sort of intense visualization, the power of intense visualization, becomes stronger and stronger and may leap over into hallucination at one point. Since one doesn't feel responsible for a hallucination, since it comes from elsewhere, a hallucination can be the point at which one gets converted. You know, you're merely imagining things up to that point, but then it's there.
Interesting. One of the things that I wanted to talk about is we're coming up on the 150th, or we are in the 150th anniversary of the Civil War. And when many people think Civil War, they think death, they think destruction, they think amputations. And you talk extensively in your book about phantom limbs. And when a person who had a limb amputated still feels the presence of that limb. And it is classified as a hallucination, but not like the hallucinations of sight and sound. What is it about phantom limbs that makes them unique?
The term phantom limbs was invented by Weir Mitchell, and it's there was a hospital here in Philadelphia, you must know, which was colloquially called the Stump Hospital. And Weir Mitchell spoke to dozens or hundreds of soldiers who'd had amputations, and most of them said they could still feel the limb. And sometimes there was such a sense of conviction that people would step off a curb with a non-existent leg, with a phantom limb, and break the other one or whatever. The phantom limbs tend to occur in like close to 100% of people. There's something wrong with one if one doesn't get a phantom after an amputation, because a phantom is really based on the representation of the body image in the brain. And it only appears strange when part of the body has been removed, but the image is still there. Considering that, you know, people have lost limbs for thousands of years, and no doubt all of them had phantoms, it's strange that there weren't earlier descriptions. There's a lovely description in Moby Dick, which, of course, Ahab has a a phantom. I love finding literary or artistic depictions which come before scientific ones. I don't know whether Weir Mitchell had read Moby Dick. Well, he probably had. He was a novelist too. A phantom can be neutral or pleasurable or painful. There's a danger that phantoms contract and become painful. For example, Nelson, after he'd lost one of his arms, developed a clenched fist which seemed to be budding from his shoulder, or the intermediate part of the arm wasn't represented. There are now, just in the last 15 years, a very simple but wonderful way, using a mirror, of relieving phantom pain and the feeling of a distorted phantom. And there are also all sorts of ways, quite simple ways, using video goggles, of giving normal people the sense of a phantom. And I have a feeling that you are working on something of the sort at the museum.
We are. Should I spill the beans on a... Well, we're having a Civil War exhibit opening in September, and we're going to have a booth where you can go in and experience what it's like to have your arm amputated. So you'll have to come in mid-September. Sorry, sidebar. Pain.
There are all sorts of phantoms. One sort is an entire phantom body, is a hallucination of oneself, will mirror one's gestures and be dressed like one. Linnaeus, the great botanist, would have these hallucinations in attacks of migraine. And he was very much at ease. He would joke about it. He would be with the students. He'd open a door and say, "Oh, I'm already here."
I was, of course, familiar with the phantom limb in the sense that you're missing it. You have an amputated limb. But you say there's also phantom limbs where you have an extra limb.
Yeah.
And that is something I'd never heard about before.
There's a worker in Sweden, Olsen, who uses simple methods, video goggles, rubber hand, and this sort of thing to give people all sorts of, I don't know whether one should call them illusions or hallucinations, but one of the strangest ones is the third arm, when you feel an arm coming out of your side. You know it's not there, but the feeling, you know, won't go away. Insight doesn't help in this sort of situation. Weir Mitchell also described the opposite, which at one time he called the negative phantom, when someone had, say, a bad leg injury, and a lot of nerve damage in the leg, so they couldn't feel the leg properly and couldn't send signals to it. Mm-hmm. They then might disown the limb and mm-hmm. feel it was not theirs. And this is something I know well for myself, because I had this after an accident on a mountain some years ago.
Now, you were talking about that, but isn't there a condition where a person has a perfectly healthy leg or limb but feels that it is not theirs and would very much like to have it amputated, but there's nothing wrong with it? What is that?
I got a number of letters from people who said that, and I at first thought that this was a particularly bizarre delusion, but then I wondered if it could have some neurological basis, and I referred most of the people to Ramachandran, but it does seem that that part of the body image may be missing. And if, say, one's left hand is not represented in the brain, then the left hand will seem an alien thing attached to one. And an obliging surgeon may remove it for one. I think it's a complex thing ethically. Incidentally, the opposite can happen. People who are born without limbs, from thalidomide or something, may nonetheless have vivid phantoms. And there's one case of a little limbless girl who did calculation using her phantom fingers.
And she had never had fingers in her entire life?
She'd never had any limbs. She'd never had any limb experience, although she had watched other people using their limbs.
Interesting. I want to talk about pain for a little bit, because pain is fascinating, and it's something that we've all experienced to some degree or another. And my question is, if you are feeling pain, is it a hallucination? Because it's such an internal effect, it's such an internal thing, that if I'm experiencing pain, I'm experiencing pain, and I don't need any external validation. So if I feel pain, am I in pain?
No, it's pain is a sensation. There may be, and it's a sensation which is, I think, very difficult to remember or imagine. So that, say, people who've gone through agonies in childbirth can't. They can say, "I had terrible pain," but they can't actually evoke it. Or recall it in their body, perhaps fortunately. There are some perhaps forms of hallucinatory pain which the insane can get. I think it's probably worth saying that, you know, people immediately associate hallucinations with schizophrenia, with voices and things. I don't know whether I have another book in me, but I think that requires a separate book by someone else. I'm concerned, you know, a lot of papers in the 19th century were called Hallucinations in the Sane. Mind you, I think there's a very fuzzy border, and I think we're all slightly crazy for some of the time.
Some more so than others. I agree. You were talking about your hallucination of indigo. And would you consider that to be your most pleasant hallucination?
I miss that, sir.
Your hallucination when you experienced indigo.
Yes.
Did you consider that to be your most pleasant hallucination?
I'm missing it. Did I?
Was that your most pleasant? Did you enjoy that
yeah.
the most?
Yeah, I enjoy that very much. It went with a feeling of ecstasy.
What would you consider to be your worst?
I think probably certain hypochondrias, or perhaps they were valid when I thought I had taken a fatal dose of something, and my heart was pounding very rapidly. I seem to tend to hypochondria more than paranoia, but they're a very unpleasant pair.
Now, it seems that, again, when I've read the book and when we're talking about it, there's a lot of pleasant and positive connotations of hallucination. I think if you would poll most people, hallucinations are something they don't want to have. Science, medicine is involved in researching hallucinations so we can cure them, for the most part. Do you believe that? I mean, it sounds like you're more of an advocate of proper hallucinating.
I think one, you know, one needs to know the person and their circumstance as well, and what sort of hallucinations they're having, what they feel about it. Not everybody wants to get rid of hallucinations. And sometimes hallucinations can be put to use. I see a lot of blind people and deaf people working in old age homes, and those who are blind or half blind tend to get visual hallucinations. Those who are deaf get usually musical hallucinations. And sometimes the hallucinations can keep one company. But those can certainly be treated to some extent with a small dose of tranquilizer. But you've got to find the cause. A particular form of hallucination is the one which follows, and this must have followed the Civil War, along with phantoms, people who've been in horrifying battle scenes surrounded by corpses can have flashbacks of this. The precise memory can't be recalled consciously, but may appear involuntarily, either as dreams or as hallucinations. And these can be very tormenting and very dangerous. You know, in the Vietnam War, some veterans might suddenly imagine the Kong were all around them, and if they had a gun, they would shoot people down. People who were in concentration camps often had vivid hallucinations. Sometimes they would hallucinate the smell of the gas ovens for years afterwards. There, a particular sort of hallucination which Weir Mitchell himself had at one time. He lost a very dear friend. It was very sudden. And when he came down the stairs, he would see the head of his friend sort of glimmering and semi-transparent. But the bereavement hallucinations are quite common. They occur the longer and the happier a marriage, the more likely a bereavement hallucination is. And people seem to enjoy seeing and sometimes talking to the departed people. They may feel it as part of the process of mourning, and perhaps it does fill an agonizing hole, you know, and help it to heal.
Wonderful. Well, I think we're out of time for our portion now, so I think what we're going to do is look for cards. Wonderful, thank you. Yeah. All right.
I don't see how we can. We've only just started.
I know. Did we hallucinate that the time went by a little quicker than it did? All right, I have a card here. Could you discuss imaginative play in small children and how it may relate to hallucinations?
So say that again.
Could you discuss imaginative play in small children and how it may relate to hallucinations?
I'm still missing
imaginative.
It.
I was imaginary friends. How children
oh,
play.
Oh yes,
with
I'm
small.
Sorry. Right. Yeah. A lot of kids have imaginary friends, especially if they are only children or lonely. And they may talk or play for hours with their imaginary friends, who are imagined in very great detail, although it seems more than imagination to them. They seem to have some control. I think imaginary friends tend to disappear, usually around the age of 6 or 7. But at the age of 3 or 4, it may not be too easy for the child to distinguish imagination from reality. But one certainly wouldn't want to deprive a child of an imaginary friend.
Right. And could it be considered a valuable part of childhood?
Yeah, I think so.
We have here, what is your standpoint regarding repeated earth lives, reincarnation, in relation to hallucinations?
What is my attitude about reincarnation?
Reincarnation in relation to hallucinations.
There is a very popular book. It's headed the bestseller lists for a year or more, called Proof of Heaven, and has the subtitle A Neurosurgeon's Journey into the Afterlife. The neurosurgeon, Eben Alexander, had a very nasty meningitis and was in coma for a few days. But then he started to come out of this, and he recounted a very elaborate experience. This sort of near-death experiences can occur sometimes when people have had heart attacks or cardiac arrest, in which the person appears to, perhaps there initially may be darkness, then one seems to move up to be drawn up some bright column, and he felt that he was drawn into a sort of heaven. Conversion is not uncommon with this sort of experience. And he was certainly converted with a vengeance. And I don't know how much he's converted his 2 million readers, who are obviously very, very eager and anxious, would very much like a heaven. He maintains that this was not a hallucination. He says he was in coma, the nervous system, the brain couldn't have been active. But it was a hallucination, and a hallucination, strictly speaking, tells one about the brain, mm-hmm. which has produced it. Although the term veridical is often used, that if you have a hallucination of heaven, another surgeon whom I wrote about in an earlier book, was in fact, I think, converted to a belief in reincarnation by a somewhat similar experience. He'd been struck by lightning, and he described having been flung back by the lightning bolt and then coming forward and seeing his own apparently dead body beneath him and someone doing CPR. And then he felt himself being drawn up to God. And then suddenly, he said, he was back again. They'd got his heart restarted. So his whole journey took about 25 seconds. But he was a different man afterwards. He was converted to a belief in reincarnation, also to a passionate love for music, especially of Chopin, and he became a composer himself. Now, when he came to me, he said, "I've had this big spiritual change. What's going on in my brain? Or can you find anything in the brain which might explain it?" That seems to me good. That seems to me a good attitude. Whereas Eben Alexander says it's nothing to do with the brain.
Interesting.
And I think uses his neurological credentials to justify.
Now, when it comes to near-death experiences, why is it that so many people, independently, that never have met each other, different cultures, different everything, still have that very similar experience, that bright light, the tunnel, sometimes seeing themselves yeah. above? What is there a physiological reason for that?
There have certainly been some physiological investigations. Of course, it's not easy to get people when they're having a near-death experience. It would be very convenient if one could induce these experiences without being near-death. Indeed, I would like to have one myself.
Right.
See what it's like. But the bright light and sometimes associated with constriction of arteries going to the eye, and, mm-hmm. and there's a sort of greying out or something akin to what pilots may get, there are half a dozen physiological things going on which might explain this, mm-hmm. and also the sort of out-of-body experience. The out-of-body experience, when you just see yourself, is easy to simulate.
Wonderful.
And if you go to Dr. Ersson in Sweden, he will show you how it's done.
That is really tempting. Now, we have another question here. Were you able to find new techniques to awaken more patients? I think this harkens back to awakenings.
Yeah. Well, first, patients. By the way, I want to apologize to you lot. I'm blind in my right eye. I can't see my hand. I can't see you, but I know you're there. But I hope you're not feeling neglected. Now I've forgotten the question.
I found a better one.
Awakenings. No. Well, my patients were already in their 50s and 60s when I saw them. They had become ill in the 20s, and now they are gone, and there's never been a comparable epidemic. Mm-hmm. But the drugs which were used then are used in the treatment of Parkinson's disease, and they are very effective, although there are other techniques now. And some people who were considered to be in vegetative states with no consciousness are now known to have some consciousness if you have them wired up for functional brain imaging and say, imagine you're playing tennis, mm-hmm. whatever, you may see the right sort of activity in the brain.
Interesting. We have another question here. Why does smoking pot enhance the performance of certain musicians and dancers, but not others? Why does smoking pot enhance the performance of certain musicians and dancers, but not others?
There are great individual variations, and there are variations for the individual. And smoking it will give you a great experience one time and a sort of nightmare the next. One might wonder whether some of the people who get liberated by it have lost some of their inhibitions. I don't know.
I don't think I'm going to ask you this.
incidentally, it's been found that improvisers are to some extent able to turn off some of their frontal lobe inhibitions and just let it flow.
How did you feel about the thinly veiled portrait of you in Richard Powell's novel, The Echo Maker?
The what?
The Echo Maker. Richard Powell's novel, The Echo Maker. How did you feel about the thinly veiled portrait of you?
I don't know the book.
Moving on. Good question. Did you ever have...
Incidentally, there have been several uses of me by a very brilliant novelist, a sort of genius called Will Self in England.
Wonderful. Did you ever covet a patient's hallucination? Did you ever hear about one of your patient's hallucinations and think, I really wish I could have come up with that?
Well, I don't know whether covet is quite the right word, but I wish I could share in some benign way all of my patient's experiences, from terrible as well as wonderful. As a doctor, I have to imagine what is it like to be someone else, that person in that situation.
I cannot read that one. How do hallucinations affect the thalamocortical loop and one's sense of consciousness and self-agency?
First, I think one needs to say that hallucinations activate those parts of the brain which are normally being used for perception, for example, for visual perception. And the parts of the brain which are involved need to be active, and if they're not being fed from the eyes, they will then reach down into memory or whatever and generate their own activity. As in a sense happens when one dreams, and then sort of information from the body is not available. And by definition, a hallucination is conscious. What's that? You know, one looks around, and hears something, and certainly the parts of the brain involved with consciousness, the thalamocortical cortical loop and so forth, show an immediate activation, identical or almost identical with what one would have for the real perception. This doesn't happen with imagination. There's a nice experiment. If one has a rotating drum with slits, the eyes jerk as they follow the movement. If you now ask someone to close their eyes and imagine a rotating drum, they may say they're imagining it, but their eyes don't move. But if you hypnotize them and ask them to hallucinate a rotating drum, then their eyes move and their brain changes just as if they were seeing it. So hallucination is very, very real. It is taking over parts of the brain which are normally employed in perception.
This is not a question here. If somebody is hypnotized, can the person hypnotizing them induce a hallucination in them?
I'm missing this.
Could a hypnotist induce a hallucination in somebody via hypnotism?
Yes. There's a terrifying story by Thomas Mann called Mario and the Magician, in which a stage hypnotist gets the young man under, and on the stage he has the hypnotized man believe that he is in fact the man's mistress, the girl he's in love with. And when he snaps his fingers and ends the charade, the humiliated young man rushes out and turns around and shoots the hypnotist right at the end. It's a great story.
With a happy ending?
And one of my patients was going to turn it into an opera. I don't know whether he did or not. It's real. It's very operatic.
I think that's an interesting segue into the moral and ethical implications of brain manipulation, inducing hallucinations. What is the medical profession's responsibility as we know more about the brain and as we have the increased ability to manipulate the brain? We really need to think about where do we stop?
Right.
I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
Right back in the 1960s, it was found that if rats had electrodes inserted into certain parts of the brain, which were later called reward centers, they would then experience something probably very rewarding or very pleasurable if they pressed a lever. And rats in this state would press the lever, would cease to eat, cease to do anything else, and they would press the lever till they died. But artificial and enhanced states are just around the corner. I mean, we already see them in athletes with steroids, and in a good way with the amazing, you know, prostheses which are made. At one time, sort of bilateral amputees were only allowed in the Paralympics. Now they are actually excluded from the Olympics, some of them, because it's felt that the prostheses may give them an unfair advantage. and the notion of unfair advantage as available for some people and not for others is going to be a very big issue.
Wonderful. We have time for one more. I'm trying to find one that I like. All right, well, how have you used the arts to help patients? How have you used the arts to help patients? Have you actively utilized music, artwork?
Oh, art, I'm sorry. Yeah. Well, I've been most concerned with the powers of music. I first saw that with my awakenings patients who were often motionless and speechless. But if music played, if it was the right sort of music, they could dance and they could sing and they could be activated by the music, but stop suddenly as they started. And here it's built into the human brain that we respond to rhythms. You know, children do so. Other primates don't, and dogs don't. I mentioned this once, and a woman in the audience said, "Now I know why I never got my dog to dance." but people with Parkinson's can dance. So this giving movement is one thing, but also music can act as a bridge to language and to memory, which one may not have access to. For example, people with aphasia who can't express themselves in language may be able not only to sing, but may put the words to it. You were all kind enough to sing Happy Birthday when I came in, but I will often sing Happy Birthday to a patient with aphasia, even if it's not their birthday, and they will join in, and perhaps joining in, find some of the words which shows them that words are there, even if apparently embedded in music, but one can sometimes disembed it. I think that music can be very important for people with who have lost their memory, who are amnesic, and who have Alzheimer's, and it may often be the only way of bringing back some scene or feeling or incident from the past which they can no longer approach directly. So my experience has been mostly with music, but I know, you know, visual art can be very important, and certainly I think one needs to have all the art facilities available, sort of books and painting and sculpture and outside things and gardens. I think all the creative and performance arts are healing. Novalis, the poet, used to say that every disease is a musical problem, every cure is a musical solution, which encapsulates it nicely.
Well, thank you very much. We're out of time, so... Thank you for your questions.
And thank you, Anna Doty, for a terrific job. Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.